Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail.
Welcome to the final Retail Focus Podcast for 2020. I'm Trent Kling. Glad you could join us this week. Our interview guest is Sajug Agarwal. He is the founder of Movly, and Movly is a firm that deals primarily in inspections with Chinese manufactured products. And he's actually going to talk about something that we've never addressed on the podcast before, the process behind inspections in China, where that process currently sits, what the status quo is, and where he would like to see the status quo move to as we head further into the next decade. This is a topic that oftentimes flies under the radar for a lot of retailers, but is it ever important? So happy to have Sajug on the show to discuss that topic and much more. I guarantee you the topic goes deeper than you ever imagined in terms of those inspections for Chinese manufactured products. We'll also look ahead to small to mid-size market sales as it pertains to retail. But our lead story, early numbers from MasterCard that indicate a middle-of-the-road jump in holiday season spending. A reminder that you can like us and rate us. However you access us, if you enjoy the show, please give us a rating. It helps others to find the Retail Focus Podcast and check out our weekly supply of interviews that we bring you. Additionally, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram at Retail Podcast. This upcoming week, actually the next couple of weeks, we'll be tweeting out some of our favorite interviews, certainly from the year 2020. I know it was a difficult year for many, certainly a tumultuous year as it pertained to retail, but we talked to a lot of incredibly intelligent people about different facets of retail. So if you're new to the podcast, if you're new to the show, you can check us out on Twitter and Instagram, and we're going to be tweeting out about some of our favorite interviews that you might have missed from the year 2020. So let's dive into this story. This news came literally just minutes prior to us recording this podcast. And again, these numbers are from MasterCard. MasterCard usually the first numbers to come out regarding holiday season spending. To preface, we've seen predictions for an increase in holiday season spending be anywhere from around 1.5% to 5% on average. MasterCard's numbers came in right in the middle, about a 3% increase year over year. Now, some caveats here regarding the numbers. First, because MasterCard's numbers are usually the first to come out for the holiday shopping season, it doesn't necessarily mean absolute accuracy. We typically see final numbers or numbers that are given to be as final as possible, depending on the source, vary by a few tenths of a percent. And we're already seeing some sources' numbers vary a little bit. In fact, Adobe Data numbers came out this weekend as well, and those also varied by a few percent. Additionally, the period measured for MasterCard, they widened it. So it's October 11th to December 24th because they reasoned that the holiday shopping season was widened to 75 days this year as a result of those Black Friday deals being spread into October as a result of the postponement of Prime Day. So this MasterCard spending pulse data carries with it a larger time span than it typically does. So it's going to include any boost brought about by the move of Prime Day. Now, one of the bigger eye-raising numbers from this report, I thought, was online sales numbers, although not in the way most expected. Now, granted, the headlines, if you read them out there, it will say that online sales helped to drive this 3% overall retail increase, and they did. That's not untrue, but online sales rose year over year 49%. So that's not saying online sales were 49% of all sales, but it was an increase of 49% from online sales in 2019. This is nothing to scoff at, certainly. This is a massive increase for online sales, but this also indicates a lesser increase than what we had generally seen from a lot of general merchandise retailers out there like Target and Walmart. We've even talked about Costco seeing triple-digit increases or near triple-digit increases in terms of e-commerce sales. And additionally, while this number, this 49% jump year over year, it was in the wheelhouse of some predictions, it fell short of others. And more importantly, it fell short of consumers' own expectation that over 50% of their holiday shopping would occur online. We saw that in the study we've talked about on the show from Deloitte. IBM's global survey found similar consumer numbers. So again, we see this consumer divide that we had kind of hinted at maybe taking place, where consumers think they're spending more online than they actually do. And instead, in aggregate, MasterCard's data found that online shopping sales were just 19.7% of overall retail sales for the season. This number was around 13% last year. Does it represent an acceleration from where we thought it would be this year pre-pandemic? Absolutely. If you look at it through that lens, e-commerce sales have absolutely jumped year over year, but this number is dramatically below nearly every prediction that was out there. And we wouldn't be surprised if numbers actually from other agencies show an increase in e-commerce penetration as we start to get more finalized numbers in and as we start to get further from the holiday season. But that's just an interesting thing to keep in mind, is that we really didn't see the e-commerce jump to over 20% of overall retail sales for the holiday season. And this is including the movement of Prime Day into October. So I found that very interesting. And honestly, it took me by surprise. Typically, we're not the bullish sort in terms of e-commerce numbers absolutely exploding year over year. But we saw analysts throwing out 30 to 40% of overall retail sales. And here, just 19.7%. So maybe people were sheepish about shipping. Maybe people just went to the store more than they thought. But I can tell you, in my experience, and I know the plural of anecdote does not equal data, but in my experience, every general merchandise retailer I went to, every grocer I went to was packed to the gills. And I couldn't have told you the difference, honestly, in some of my shopping trips between 2020 and 2019, other than everyone was wearing masks. I went to some Target stores that appeared busier than last year. I went to a Dollar General store 3 days before Christmas, and it was more packed than I've ever seen a Dollar General store in that time of year before. So just certain things to keep in mind regarding this backdrop regarding the holiday season of 2020. And additionally, for all this hype surrounding Prime Day and the spread of Black Friday deals throughout October and November, Black Friday at the end of the day was still the top spending 24 hours of the surveyed period, according to MasterCard. So Black Friday might not be the top of the heap by as much anymore, but it is still the top shopping day of this holiday season, even when you take Prime Day and all those Prime Day deals from other retailers, not just Amazon, into account. Now, some other interesting numbers from the report, and again, this is all via MasterCard Spending Pulse data. Department stores fell 10.2% overall year over year. Apparel store sales were down 19.1% year over year. Those kind of came in where we would have assumed they came in. E-commerce and curbside for both of those categories saw a modest increase. For example, for department stores, sales touching the digital channel were up year over year 3%. Not a huge jump in aggregate when you look at just how much in terms of digital sales some of the other retailers out there are doing. Luxury took a hit, down 21% according to this data. And again, this kind of figures, given the pandemic conditions, studies noting higher than average savings rates for affluent households, makes sense that maybe luxury spending might be down. Now, furniture sales rose 16.2%. Home improvement sales continued to be strong at a 14.1% year-over-year increase. You're going to be tired of Leighton and I saying it, but more of that nesting effect certainly coming into play. Now, aside from this MasterCard Spending Pulse data, we did get data from other analytics firms, Adobe Analytics among them. They pointed to a lower than expected bump for e-commerce sales from November 1st to December 22nd. So a thinner period surveyed there, but their data indicated a 32.4% increase year over year. So when you take out that Prime Day data from October, not looking quite as good, in fact, for e-commerce. And again, a climate where a lot of analysts, a lot of analytic firms, a lot of consumers thought that spending was going to increase in the e-commerce channel over 50%. Consumers themselves, in certain cases, thought that their spend would actually be over 50% in terms of e-commerce. But at the same time, Sensormatic Solutions data, according to payments.com, indicated that 31.3% fewer people visited retailers during the holiday season versus last. So these are just raw traffic numbers. You have to figure malls factored into that in a big way, department stores, apparel retailers factored into that a big way, because again, traffic at general merchandise retailers, at least to this point in the year, hasn't been down all that much. It's been down about single digits over last year, and in some cases, pretty even with last year. So to summarize all of this, the early returns suggest a fall in traffic, an increase in basket size across platforms, because obviously we saw sales going up in general, lower than expected e-commerce increases, still better than expected e-commerce increases before the pandemic, of course, but given pandemic conditions, lower than expected e-commerce increases in terms of overall share of retail sales, Overall sales increase year over year coming in at a modest level, maybe on the lower end of some expectations, certainly on the lower end of NRF expectations. Again, these numbers might be adjusted as we get more data from the holiday season. But in all, there's not really a substantial headline here. There's not a huge surprise here, other than maybe the e-commerce sales part, but most of these trends are consistent with what we saw in the back half of 2020 in general on the retailer level. E-commerce sales didn't spike compared with Q2 and Q3 of 2020. Other sales didn't spike. Other sales didn't fall off. It was pretty well consistent the last 3 months of 2020 with what we'd seen in the prior 6 months of 2020. So not super sexy in terms of there not being a concrete headline, but interesting data nonetheless, and certainly we'll be looking ahead to other data as it comes out, and I'm sure we'll talk to a number of folks from these data firms regarding their particular data that they'll bring in regarding the holiday season. Now it's time for our interview with Sajog Agarwal, once again, the founder of Movly, and a topic that initially you look at, it doesn't sound that exciting, inspections in China for products, but it is absolutely crucial to the retail process, and Sajog is going to talk a lot about what the inspection process does entail, what the inspection process should entail if done correctly, and ways in which retailers should be safeguarding themselves against the possibility of a poor inspection. It seems like a century ago, but it wasn't that far back that retailers were wringing their hands over trade issues with China. Management of retailers were constantly asked on earnings calls about their exposure to China, and as it turns out, most retailers do source a significant number of products from China. Now, although those who aren't directly involved with the product sourcing process don't consider this on a day-to-day basis, there are a lot of steps involved in creating and then bringing an item from China to North America. Chief among these steps is the inspection process. Now, what does this process entail? How can the process be improved? And moreover, what are the ramifications of an ineffective inspection? Here to answer those questions and more is Sajog Agarwal, the founder of Movly. Movly assists in brand manufacture of products in China by utilizing on-the-ground quality control inspections. The products they inspect, by the way, end up anywhere from shelves at Walmart to small e-commerce startups. Sajog, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me on, Trent.
I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what pushed you to start Movly in the first place and detail kind of what Movly does on the day-to-day.
Yeah, definitely. So actually before Movly, I used to run my own direct-to-consumer brand. And we dealt in everything from electronics all the way down to more simple cell phone accessories, you know, so cases, things like that. We sold in brick and mortar. We also sold mainly on Amazon. And what ended up happening is we ended up seeing a lot of quality control problems. We were seeing 5 to 10% defect rates, dead on arrival or broken units. And we were seeing 100% failure rates in some of our SKUs after a few months of use. And this was all despite getting past inspections on all of our orders and with some of our competitors. So what ended up happening is I actually moved to China and I lived in Shenzhen for about 6 months. This was back in 2017. And I was kind of doing my own inspections, watching my own inspectors. I even hired my own in-house team. And they actually started taking bribes from the factory. So it was just a complete mess. And we ended up still having bad quality control problems. So after that, I actually went ahead and founded Movly because I talked to a lot of brick and mortar, a lot of e-commerce sellers and asked them, you know, hey, do you trust your inspections company? And every single person I spoke to told me, no, we don't trust our inspections company, but it's better than doing nothing. And I was just shocked. I was like, you know, where at the time it was like 2018, we have Elon Musk just starting to talk about Neuralink. We have AI coming out. We can't make sure that, you know, inspections are done properly in another country. Just sounded ridiculous to me. So that's when I founded Movly. And at Movly, what we do is we do quality control inspections on the ground, and we do them a little bit differently. So we really try to humanize the process. We look at on the relationship model from the inspection process to working with the inspectors all the way down to the factories. And we also are building a tech platform out for inspections. So I always like to say we're not perfect. Just like any other inspection company, we have our flaws. But with our new processes, with the tech we have in place right now, we're about 2 to 3 times more effective than the next best competitor. And we're working to get to a 10x level with building out our tech platform, getting body camera footage and real-time data insights to be able to do inspections a lot more effectively and efficiently.
So you kind of mentioned it there, but you know, from the retail perspective, you were seeing things like bribes, you were seeing, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff eventually pass QC. Get to your retail shelves and then it was essentially needing to be returned by the customers or something happened to it. And as you mentioned, 5 to 10% dead on arrival. So all that being said, we could talk about intricacies of this process all day, but at a high level, what's the inspection process currently like in China? What's the current state of inspections outside of Mavli there?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the current state of inspections, it's pretty much systematically built to pass your products. So most inspection companies do not actually test your products. They just visually look at your products. So if you go on some of the most popular inspection services, the ones that are sponsored by, you know, your big companies, what ends up happening is you'll notice is that they advertise, look at product conformity for maybe 1 to 10 units. They'll visually inspect maybe 200-300 units. But product conformity might be 10 units. Function tests might be 1 to 3 units. And when you're doing like an inspection, say you have like electronics product and you want to plug in the product, you know, like you have a lamp, you want to make sure it works. If you're only testing 1 to 3 units, you can have like a 40% defect rate. And you have a pretty high chance of not catching any defects at all in that inspection, just because the sampling is not done properly. So there's a lot of flaws when it comes to the sampling process we've seen and when it comes to the overall process for the inspection. So like most inspection companies right now, we've noticed are either giving their inspectors too little time, having enough accountability, or they're not doing the process correctly, where the inspection is just coming out as passed or it's being done ineffectively. It's almost like a placebo.
So that being said, obviously there are a lot of inspections that either fall short of making sure a product works or making sure a shipment will work. What are some ramifications when an inspection just doesn't pass muster in and of itself in the case of maybe a retailer or a seller receiving a bad order?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So returns is the biggest thing. So right off the bat, you have a huge return percentage. So if you're selling on Amazon e-commerce and you're doing, you know, direct merchant fulfillment or something like that, it can hit your account and you can have a lot of returns and negative reviews, which can, you know, sink all sales moving forwards. And warranty claims is also a really big problem. So with my previous brand, we had a lot of issues with warranty claims. So some of our products, we gave warranties of 1 to 2 years to match our competitors and sometimes a little bit more. And when we started having quality control problems, we were on the hook to replace those products to make sure that they were functioning. Because essentially at the end of the day, if the product stops working in the warranty period, it's generally a manufacturing defect. So it can really affect the bottom line and really rack up a lot of expenses. And what's really terrible about that is they're unexpected. So you're not going to find quality control problems like in the first month. A lot of times they're going to show up on the third month or the fourth month after they get sold, at least with warranty claims. And that can create a lot of issues planning out budgets and affecting the bottom line down the line.
Now, I'm kind of curious, given this and given that the fact that the system is set up ultimately to pass these products through rather than fail them, let's say an inspection takes place and that there is a failed inspection. What happens next? What are the ramifications then for the supplier? Or how do you go about breaking that relationship if you need to?
That's a really good question. So when it comes down to working with the supplier, what I always like to say is work with the suppliers like they're your partner. After all, you know, a lot of people look at suppliers in China very transactionally, like, hey, I'm giving you money, I'm expecting a product back. But in reality, they're more so partners in your business and you want to give them a holistic overview of what's going on in your business so they kind of understand your perspective and what issues you're dealing with. So if you have a good relationship with your factory, you can always talk with them, kind of give them the more holistic perspective. I always like to say, you know, try to extend an olive branch. So if it's like a big problem and there's a lot of units defective, maybe offer to split the cost of repair 50-50 or something like that to actually fix those problems. But generally work with your factory, fix the problems. And if the factory is being uncooperative, they're not letting you do thorough inspections, they're not letting you see your products essentially, you know, before you actually get them shipped and purchased, and they're just not working with you, at that time, it might be worthwhile to break the relationship. And the easiest way to go about that is just cold turkey. So, you know, find another supplier, line up things, do a test order, have that supplier up and running, maybe do a little bit of a dual order, do a couple of units from your old supplier, a couple of units from the new supplier, make sure the quality is on point with your new supplier, and then just move over all manufacturing to the new one.
So all that being said, you mentioned earlier that a lot of problems you might not realize as a retailer until 3-4 months down the line when the product begins to fail the ultimate end user. What are some processes in place that you use to kind of determine how you test those type of things out to determine what wear will look like maybe 3-4 months down the road?
Yeah, so one of the best things to do is look online. So all products, even if you're selling on Walmart, your product, you're going to see a lot of competitors of your product online. So check online, find the negative reviews for your competitors and kind of just forecast, you know, what are the most common issues that I'm probably going to see? and then kind of work backwards from there. So I always like to say work from the customer backwards. So if the customer is going to use the product very aggressively, maybe have the inspector, you know, use the product a little bit more aggressively. For example, let's say you have a wooden shell. You know the customer is probably not going to pay attention to the weight limit, even if the weight limit's 100 pounds. So maybe you want to make sure that your shelf can hold up to 150 pounds before breaking. So that's something like you can do in the inspection process. Another way to really come up with high quality effective tests is talk to suppliers and do that in the sales process. So when you're sourcing with 10 different manufacturers and you're talking to them and they're telling you they want to make sure that, you know, you work with their factory and they're going to do the best they can to sell you on their factory. And one of the best questions to ask is, what are your quality control procedures? What are your quality control tests that you do during the production process on, you know, these units? And understand what machinery they have to test quality and understand what tests they do. And when you talk to 15 different suppliers, you're going to get a lot of different perspectives and you're going to get a lot of different angles on a lot of different tests. And that's a great source of information to aggregate and then put together in an inspection specification.
Now, you mentioned it can be up to that inspector to make sure, you know, if something's going to be used in a little bit of a rough manner, to make sure they test that product out in the same manner. But we talked earlier about a lot of inspectors oftentimes being overworked, or they're doing 3 to 4 inspections per day, and they might not have the time it takes necessary, at least as it stands currently, that current state macro level of inspections in China. Where does the inspection process need to be as far as making sure that the inspectors have the time and the tools necessary to do their jobs?
Yeah, so when it comes to time calculations, most inspection companies should be calculating out how much time the inspection takes down to the test. So if you're doing 5 or 10 wear or tear tests on each unit, that's going to take a lot more time than if you're just visually inspecting the product. So for example, like this is what we do at Movly, and this is what all inspection companies should be doing. It's kind of just common sense for us. Is, you know, we should be looking at the amount of time every test takes during an inspection process and then make sure the inspector has enough time based on industry averages, factoring in how many units we're visually inspecting, how many units are being tested, how many units are being opened, et cetera. And one of the things that is really effective is that, you know, the times can improve with every product because every product is widely different. So like one of the things that we practice, for example, is having a bill on maximum time guarantee. So we'll quote you out, let's say 3 days. And if the inspection takes 2 days, then great. You get a credit for the day. But if you take 4 days, then, you know, the time codes can be revised the next time around. So that way the inspection is not underquoted or overquoted. And that way there's a little bit of flexibility on the first few inspections, but on the following inspections, you can use actual data to determine how long that inspection should actually take.
Certainly an interesting approach. A lot of things to keep in mind. Now, we've talked about a lot of different aspects as it pertains to inspections, but just for the average person in North America that doesn't know much about inspections, what's one aspect of the process that might catch them off guard or they might not know about looking at the surface?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think the biggest thing that catches people off guard is product tests. That's what we've seen. So a lot of people have this misconception that the inspection company should know everything about their product. So when you hire an inspection company, they're essentially guaranteeing you that the quality of the product is top notch. But an inspection company's job is to verify the product quality according to your standards. So for example, you can have 2 combs. You can have a flimsy dollar store comb, and you can also have a luxury comb. Now, the inspection company is not going to know the difference because they don't know your audience. So the inspector might think, hey, you know, your luxury comb is a little bit flimsy, but maybe it's being sold in a dollar store. So the inspector might say, hey, you know, this is a pass. But, you know, for you, it may not be a pass because it's being sold for maybe $20 for 1 comb. So the inspection company's job is to verify that the specifications are, you know, done properly and the product quality is good, but their job is not to guarantee your quality. Understand the quality control processes of your product and then making sure the inspection company is armed with that information and they know exactly what is allowed and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable to be able to do that inspection thoroughly and properly.
Now, as someone that's fairly new to this process myself and doing a little bit of research for this interview, it seems like there's a dialogue out there about where the inspections should take place, whether they should take place at the port, whether they should take place at a separate facility, at the manufacturer's facility. In terms of, I mean, you've obviously been immersed in inspections now for 3 to 4 years. What are some best practices that you've seen as far as where physically these inspections should be taking place?
Yeah, definitely. And this is something that's up for debate. But in my opinion, and based on kind of what we've seen with our data and our performance, the inspection should ideally be done at the factory. And there's a couple of different reasons for this. First of all, once you've shipped it over to like a warehouse or a port, generally you've lost your leverage with payment. You've already sent the final payment for the order, so you don't have any leverage over the factory. So it's always good to have a little bit of financial leverage over the factory before, you know, so if something goes wrong, you have some leverage to get those issues fixed and doing an inspection before that happens. The second thing is that factories are building products. And when you're building a product, you have a lab. You should have a lab to test the products that you're building. You should have procedures and processes in place to make sure that the products are built properly. You should have machinery, you should have space. And obviously you're doing the packaging at the factory as well. So when an inspector comes, they open up a bunch of units. Sometimes those units have to be repackaged. If you're at a port, you're not going to have the right repackaging machines. There's also not going to be a lot of room to do an inspection. That's where the factory becomes super, super useful. And additionally, when you're using more complex tests like wear and tear tests, you might have to use the factory machinery to actually do those tests. Now, if you're not actually at the factory, you don't have access to that machinery. And a general warehouse or a port is not going to have 20, 30 different lab testing machines for every type of product in existence. So it really makes a lot more sense to do them at the factory than the port. Just so, you know, if something goes wrong, or even if the products have to be repackaged, there's also more room, more tests, more detailed tests, lab machines. You really don't get any of those benefits at the port. The other problem also is that most inspection companies that do inspections at the port, they're usually freight forwarding companies. And the problem with that is that most freight forwarding companies don't understand the core process of inspections. They don't do them properly. They don't do them to statistical significance. And not only don't they not have the resources to do it, like the machinery, things like that, but you know, they're also incentivized to pass your inspection because they make more money when your products ship versus if your products are sent back.
Some interesting points there. I want to hit on something you discussed right at the beginning of your answer there, because you were talking about financial leverage. And I think that's something else that shocked me, was that there's not a lot of recourse if you get a bunch of bad products in. It seems like there's not a lot of recourse that you've got against the manufacturer. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's depending on your contracts and your orders. Like even in China, contracts are enforceable, but they're very expensive. Lawyers that work in China, for example, China-US law, are very, very expensive. The good lawyers are going to be charging $800 to $1,500 an hour. And just putting together very effective contracts can cost, you know, tens of grand for, you know, any given order. So unless you're doing millions a year in manufacturing and you have hundreds and thousands of dollars to spend on legal fees, things like that, in most cases, you don't have a lot of leverage or against your supplier. And even if you have a really well-detailed contract, a lot of times there's vague areas, gray areas and points where it may not hold up very strictly in court. So it just becomes very, very difficult. So for the average, you know, manufacturer, the average brand, they don't want to deal with legal issues. They just want to get the products out to the market and do that as quickly and as effectively as possible. That's kind of the situation when it comes to legality and manufacturing in China.
How often should these inspections be done? Or from your perspective and from your data, how often should this be happening?
Yeah, so when it comes to inspection frequency, inspections should be done at least at the end of production, like a pre-shipment inspection on every single order. And the reason for that is that, you know, if there is a quality control problem, we've spoken with clients who have come to us on the first order with defective units. And we've had clients come to us on the second, the fifth, the 10th order with defective products. And we've even had clients call us after working with the supplier for 2-3 years and then all of a sudden having quality control problems 2 or 3 years into the arrangement. And when you have one bad order, we actually did a calculation, and I'm sure everybody listening to this podcast is manufacturing at a level much, much higher than this. So it's even more of a gravitational issue for them. But if you have, you know, even a $3,000 order, that's enough to pay for about 10 inspections directly. And once you take into account returns and warranty claims from about $3,000 of defective goods, that's enough to pay for your inspections for 7 years if you do them quarterly. So when that one bad order hits, whether it's the first order or the 20th order, that one bad order is enough to pay for all your inspections for decades, especially on the larger orders, if not centuries. So that's where it really becomes very impactful to do that inspection on every single order, because it helps you verify that, hey, the quality is correct, the quality is good. So you don't have the issues once you've already spent the money and once your customers are finding those problems.
Now, I wanted to wrap up with this, because at the very beginning of the interview, you talked about certain things that you were hoping to implement, certainly with Movly here in the next couple of years. What is the landscape of inspections going to look like, or what do you hope it looks like in 2022 in terms of maybe some new technologies or new techniques being used?
That's a really good question. I'm really hoping to see inspections take a more holistic approach. For example, it's an iterative process. So inspections are not going to always be great at the get-go. They get better with every order. So as you find new defects, you find new problems, you can recycle that customer feedback back into the inspection process to do more effective inspections. So what I'm hoping to see in about a year or two when it comes to inspections is that we have a strong digitization of the entire process and more data analytics to be able to see the effects of inspections on product quality. You know, are we seeing less returns? Are we seeing more returns? Do they correlate to more issues with a certain inspection that we've done in the past, things like that, and being able to track that on a very specific data level to be able to actually see, okay, hey, this is exactly what's happening in my supply chain when it comes to quality control. And, you know, maybe this visual defect here, like loose threads, correlates more to negative reviews for the product falling apart after 3 months of use. To be able to see those distinctions and those connections and then be able to aggregate that data on an industry level. So that way, you know, any seller or any manufacturer, even if you're not, you know, a apparel king, for example, you can get those level of insights, you know, as if you're manufacturing apparel for decades through that tech platform and aggregating all that data.
Some really great insight about a field that we honestly haven't discussed a lot about, and hopefully our listeners found this conversation informative. I know I sure did, and I enjoyed a lot about learning about the inspection process. Once again, Sajjog, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
Thanks so much, Trent, for having me on. I hope everybody listening found this very useful.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Once again, we thank Sajjog for joining us, and you can check out more about Movly at movly.com. There's a lot of interesting aspects of it, and even if you're not a retailer that this topic necessarily touches, I think it's just interesting if you're a fan of retail to learn a little bit about it. They've actually got a video on their homepage. They've got a calculator regarding just how much a bad inspection could cost a retailer over time. So lots of interesting data on their website. Highly recommended. Again, that's Movly, Movley.com. Now, in our looking ahead segment, it would be easy enough to say we're looking ahead to 2021. I think at this point, everyone certainly is. We want to turn the page on the calendar that was a very tumultuous 2020, but that would be a little bit of a cop-out. And so what I'm going to do is look ahead to small and mid-sized market retail sales in 2021. Now, I've long been a proponent of the fact that I think small to mid-sized market retail sales tell you more about retail sales in the macro and how healthy households are in the macro in terms of their spending versus looking at New York or Los Angeles in isolation. And I think it's especially important given the conditions in New York City and Los Angeles where you're seeing a lot of lockdowns, you're seeing more tight conditions as it pertains to COVID than you see in other markets and certainly a lot of small to mid-sized markets out there. But the reason I'm looking ahead to this more than anything is small to mid-sized markets had a pretty good 2020 as it pertained to retail. Maybe not those apparel retailers that we associate with these type of markets. For example, of course, Gordman's, once Stage, filed bankruptcy. Kato, of course, struggled simply because of forced store closures. So you see some of that. But you also see some excellence in small to mid-sized markets. Some retailers that I typically look at to get a pulse on this, Tractor Supply Company, Hibbett Sports. And you look at Dollar General, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree as well, all of whom had pretty good to great 2020s. In fact, brick and mortar comp sales went up at Hibbett Sports 17.5% in their third quarter, which is an amazing number and certainly something that we don't see other sporting goods retailers come up with, even as that particular category is pretty strong at the end of 2020. So the reason I'm looking ahead to it is I do think that small to mid-sized markets are a little bit of a bellwether as far as indicating the overall comfort, the overall strength of household spending in the U.S., but I also want to see the reaction to some of these households as a vaccine gets implemented, as a vaccine gets distributed. I think this dynamic is going to be, in particular, pretty interesting, and when you look at certainly the farm and home retailers, the Tractor Supply Companies, the Big R's, the Atwoods of the world, if they have a lot to gain turning into 2021, because just as we've talked about this nesting effect with people buying furniture, with people buying home furnishings for their houses, people may also turn their attention even more to gardens. And you'll recall, March through May, there were a lot of areas, Michigan being one of them, that forced garden centers to close. And so people didn't really get a chance to spend a lot of time on their backyards, on their lawns. And so you wonder if maybe people have plans for spring of 2021, or if those plans will become unfulfilled because a vaccine gets distributed quicker than everyone thinks, and maybe people take off, they travel, they do other things. So I'm really anxious to see how the beginning of 2021 plays out for the small to mid-sized market retailers, for the likes of Tractor Supply, for the likes of Hibbett. And certainly we'll be keeping a close eye on that on the show for the first 6 months of next year. Well, that'll pull to a close our last show of 2020. I want to thank everyone who has listened to the show during this last year, everyone who has subscribed. We've got a lot of new subscribers during this last year, and that certainly means a lot. We've had a lot of great people join us, talk to a lot of people much smarter than I am, which is really the entire reason for the podcast in the first place. We're going to take next week off to kind of celebrate the new year on the podcast. We'll be back a couple of weeks from now. We'll have an exciting new slate of interviews tabbed for 2021. Very intrigued about some of the interviews we've got lined up for you. So excited about that. But like I said, we'll be over the next couple of weeks tweeting about some of our favorite interviews from 2020. And we certainly hope that if you're new to the show, that you check some of those out. For Leighton Behind the Scenes, I'm Trent, saying so long until 2 weeks from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.